Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I am joined by Sam, and we're going to be discussing Alpha Flight number 7 through 12 from 1984. Sam, how you doing tonight?
I am wonderful, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. And we talked about the first six issues of this a little while ago. We're coming back for the next six. And this title, again, it's John Byrne writing and drawing. I love his work. It was just a unique title back in the day, not only for Marvel, because it was set up in, you know, Canada versus, you know, New York, where almost everything else for Marvel was set, but it's also a team book where prior to the start of this series, the characters had shown up a handful of times as a team, hadn't been really well developed. So Byrne spends a lot of these issues in the first year or so telling effectively kind of one-off and two-off stories of, you know, just a character or two at a time to kind of, you know, help establish them as characters. So if you go in thinking, I'm going to get the full team, you usually don't.
Yeah. I love John Byrne. I love a lot of his work. I got to admit, this issue in particularly, I was a little confused. And oh my, is this particular issue ridiculously wordy, even for its time.
Yeah, well, again, at this point, I guess they got paid per letter or something.
This one's insane.
Yeah, number seven here focuses on Aurora and Northstar, the two twin super speedsters of the group. And I really don't know, other than the first six issues of this series, if, like, Aurora's split personality thing had been set up at all, or if that was just something Byrne added to make the character, you know, have something to do with the character.
Okay.
You know.
I can see that.
But, I mean, this issue dived deep into that area.
Yes, it did.
And we get a fair amount of her backstory and personality and all of that stuff. And we get a number of hints of Northstar being gay, but this was 1984. And they couldn't have Northstar just be openly gay for a couple of reasons. I don't think Jim Shooter would have allowed that. The whole Comics Code Authority was still a thing and might have had some pushback. And it was the 1980s. I mean, that was, you know, 40-plus years ago. They were not, we were not as open-minded as a culture at that point. So it's that it's funny, because we talk about how different the storytelling style and stuff like that is, but I think this is something that is radically different between now and then. Of then, they had a character that was gay, but they had to intentionally not make a big deal about it so they could kind of, you know, get away with doing it. Whereas now, it seems like every time I turn around, you know, particularly over at DC, another character's, you know, being declared gay or bisexual or what have you. So there's definitely differences on what was acceptable content then and now.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, but like I said, it's not a bad story. I'm not sure. Boy, there's kind of three. Well, there's two stories and an extra page in this book.
We've got the backup feature. I kind of am treating that as a separate thing. So
yeah, and then there's the like page or two at the Manitoba airport.
Yeah, that is a subplot setting up a Smart Aleck of what had been Gamma Flight for some stuff a couple issues down the line.
Exactly.
I love how they flat out tell us it's an unconnected interlude.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It actually says that on top of that page, doesn't it?
Yep. I think they're coming back to the story after the page or two, but, you know, go to the backup feature and stuff, but yeah.
Yeah. But like I say, it's not a bad story. It's actually a pretty good story. I'm not convinced. You know, we talk about things written for the trade and all that, and I would not make that argument at all about this story, but this feels like it was written for a short story or a novel or something. This is one that I feel a good prose writer could have written as a short story. And again, I love Byrne, but man, I'm not sure the artwork really helps this story. And it's not that the artwork's bad. It's in many ways not needed for the story, if that makes any sense.
It does. I think there's a lot of aspects of this era of storytelling where I don't know that the writer and artist were, even when they're the same person, which is ironic here because they definitely are.
Yep.
There's an aspect where both sides almost feel like they needed to carry the full story on their own.
Uh-huh.
So half the time you could read just the captions, the dialogue, and know what's going on. Half the time you could take those same pages, strip those things out, look just at the art, and pretty much figure out what's going on.
That is not the case in this one. At least I don't feel that way. There's a lot of jumping around. There's a lot of negative space with tons of word balloons. And again, it's not a bad story. It's just, I don't know if it's the best example of comic storytelling, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. And I'm not going to say it's the best example of John Byrne's art either. It's fine, it's good, but he's done better elsewhere.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's got that definite John Byrne look, no doubt about it.
Absolutely. He's one of those artists that has a definite signature to his style.
Yeah.
And it's a little hard to articulate exactly what it is, but, I mean, the faces, some of the body language and stuff like that is definitively him.
Absolutely.
But I thought this was a fun one. Again, really getting some time to spend with Aurora and Northstar and how they interact with each other, some of their backstory and whatnot. And it was something that, again, given how little these characters had been used, needed to be done.
Yeah, and it's interesting. In many ways, I feel we learn a lot more about Aurora than Northstar. But in another way, the story's really about the way he deals with that more than it is about her, too.
Yeah, I think there's more that we need to learn about Aurora, certainly in this issue.
Yep.
And Northstar is, I don't want to say a simpler character.
Well, but he's the one being dragged around and actually experiencing all this.
Mm-hmm.
More than, you know, we get his perspective a lot more than hers here.
Well, he's a much more external character than Aurora, whose personality disorder is all internal and stuff.
Yeah.
He's very much in people's faces and very blatant about his opinions and thoughts.
Yeah.
Which is, again, part of the fun of the two characters.
And certainly she's got plenty of dialogue and some thought balloons. But I feel like we actually have as many word bubbles from him and I think a lot more thought balloons from him. So again, if you're trying to go for the personality disorder thing, it's interesting that they choose to show it in his feelings about it more than hers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because early on when her purse gets stolen, I was reading that thinking, this would be very interesting to see a live-action adaptation of this.
Okay.
Because I think it would give that actress, whoever it was, a lot to work with.
Yeah.
You know, being the meek, mild manner, you know, Jean-Marie. And then the instant change into the, you know, very different personality of Aurora.
Absolutely, yep.
But then it comes down to, if they were to do that, how would they handle some of these things where we've got a lot of thought balloons and such?
Yeah.
So
yeah, again, it's a good story. I enjoyed it. It certainly feels important and in some ways is even in the next few issues. Again, I've only read what we're covering today and what we covered last time. So yeah, it's important and it's a good story. It's a character, you know, in some ways it's the kind of thing we didn't tend to see done back then,
well,
which is interesting.
I think in a lot of other books, you know, Fantastic Four, X-Men, Avengers, other, you know, focusing mainly on Marvel books at the moment, you'd gotten enough characterization over the course of the run of the books that you didn't really need to spend too many issues focusing on one particular character. Whereas this book is, you know, starting from almost square one, you know, at the beginning of this, and again, we're only, you know, 6 months in by the time we get to the seventh issue, it's being compared to, again, X-Men, Avengers, Defenders at the time, I guess, stuff like that, where the characters had been around for decades, even. So I think there's a foundational aspect of this first year or two of Alpha Flight where they had to really double down, if not triple down, on firmly establishing who these characters are and why we should care about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as we get to the backup, I mean, you get a very similar look at Shaman, and I'm kind of used to that with these backups. It was interesting that, and again, it's not a quality issue because I do think both of these stories have some quality. It was just, I don't know, this type of backstory feels like the things that to this point have appeared in those backups. And so it was almost like two backups. And again, not that they aren't good. They're just, oh, these are two things kind of giving us backstory and personality traits more than a current day story, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and again, this backup is giving kind of the pre-origin of Snowbird. It's also giving a little bit of the backstory of what led to the events of the first issue with Tundra.
Yeah.
So it's definitely covering a lot of ground in the couple of pages for that backup feature. And again, Alpha Flight was kind of a who were they and how did they form team at this point. So spending the backup pages doing this, I think, made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was fun stuff, but it's also the kind of thing that was atypical of the time and even more atypical in today's era.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be one thing to spend an issue of a modern book going deep into the backstory of one character or really fleshing out one character or whatever, mm-hmm. but to have done that for so many issues in a row by this point.
Yeah.
When I was reading it off the rack, I was loving it, but it was very much, it was almost an anthology book disguised as a team book. I mean, it was the same creative team, same group of characters, but different lead every other issue, it seemed like.
Well, yeah, and there was, you know, we've decried in the past, particularly when they're characters we already know, you know, like when Justice League relaunched with the New 52 and stuff, we'd say things like, oh, we got to sit through a whole arc, you know, 6, 7, 8 issues of putting the band together. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how this feels, but since at least I didn't know these characters, and it sounds like no one did, the fact that there's 9 to 12 issues of that doesn't feel as bad.
But the key difference is the band got together in the first issue.
Absolutely.
Technically, it had been together, broke it up, and got back together, but still.
Yep.
And again, prior to that, they had shown up in, all the members of Alpha Flight had shown up in, you know, at most 6 issues, and some of them were just in the background standing there, I think.
Yeah.
So they, again, didn't have much of a history. They needed to be built up. And it's, again, not like they've spent... It felt weird because it was a bunch of solo stories of different members of the same team, but they're not really acting as a team.
Yep.
But I wasn't feeling like, geez, get the band together and move on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, issue 8 kind of continues this story.
Yep.
But it seems to focus a lot more, I think, on North Star at this point. And I've got to nitpick a little on the art.
Okay.
We spend a page or so early on recapping the last issue because, well, not everyone may have read it. But when we get to page 4,
uh-huh.
North Star has crashed into this building, I guess, on the top floor, and he's sneaking around or whatever. And he goes out this one door of the bedroom he'd crashed into or what have you. How tall is that floor of the house? I mean, North Star seems to be half as tall as that interior door. So, I mean, that ceiling's got to be, what, 12, 15 feet up? Again, total nitpick.
Well, and it doesn't match the panel where he crashes through. So here's what's really interesting. If you look at the panel where he crashes through,
mm-hmm.
you can see the doorknob and you can see the two panels. And there appears to be a joist above it with some framework and decoration.
Mm-hmm.
Yet by the time he's opening that door and going out it, there are 3 panels, and the joist and framework above it look much shorter.
I wasn't sure if that was the same door or not.
Okay, fair enough.
Because he could have been into a closet or something like that. But that door, at least in that top panel, is to scale to him versus he's, you know, half the height of the other one.
It's weird because the door that he is walking through is to scale. It, you look at the doorknob and the lower two panels, it's a perfect scale door. It's just got an extra third layer to it that makes no sense.
Yep.
And again, I understand wanting the high ceilings for the extra artwork, and, you know, and in big houses like that, you may have high ceilings and vaulted ceilings, and, you know, you see some of the molding at the top and those things, but yeah, the doors don't match it.
Well, and I can see the... you know, high ceilings and stuff on the ground floor, certainly, where you'd have the dining room, the ballroom, that kind of stuff.
That's true, not in an upstairs hallway.
Yeah. That was just one of the things that just leapt out at me and such.
Fair enough. I didn't notice it, but you're absolutely right.
Complete nitpick, and I'll you know, fess up to that.
Yeah.
The other thing I had just totally forgotten, because it's been ages since I've read these early issues, I hadn't recalled that Nemesis showed up so early.
Okay.
Now, a later version of this character, or I guess possibly even plural, later versions of this character, were members of Alpha Flight.
Okay.
But not this particular version. And again, the fact that any version showed up at this point had, you know, again, I'd forgotten that. So, and this is one where some of the stuff that gets set up early in these issues, I mean, this title ran for, what, 130 issues, I think?
Okay.
So they had a lot of time to, you know, pull things back and you know, explore them in a lot more detail later.
Yep. Well, and yeah, and this title, this particular story is mythical the right word? I don't know. There's what appears to be supernatural things going on. Also, Nemesis and Ernest feel like John Byrne just wanted Daredevil and Kingpin, and they said, no, they're not in Canada, and so he just recreated them.
Yeah, kinda. Certainly, Ernest physically resembles Kingpin.
Absolutely.
The way he dresses and stuff like that.
And Nemesis kind of resembles Daredevil.
I would almost go as much Spider-Man or later Deadpool. Of course, Fair Deadpool enough. Didn't exist at this point. Yeah.
And I didn't realize it's a sword and a rapier, but the whole stick with the chain and the handle reminds me of Deadpool as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or not Deadpool.
Daredevil.
Yes.
And in fairness, Daredevil existed at this point. Deadpool did not.
Yes.
So, yeah. The part that really got me with this story was when Nemesis goes after Deadly Ernest and fairly decidedly kills him. And that was, it was not like a bloody thing or whatever, but it's like, that looked kind of messy. And I'm pretty sure somehow, although looking at this, I have no idea how, I think Deadly Ernest does show up later.
Okay.
The artwork is pretty clear as to the slicing and dicing.
Fair enough. If you choose to take it that way, absolutely.
I don't know how else you would take it.
Okay, but the body is never seen again. There's no blood anywhere.
Yes.
And arguably on the next page, when Nemesis basically knocks Northstar out by hitting him in the head, You could take that and almost say it's the same shot and it would appear that his head's being chopped off by the sword.
It flat out says the flat of her sword.
So, yeah, no, I know. I just, like I said, I don't know. And again, like you said, comics code and all, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, it looks like he is cut pretty cleanly into four or five pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the lack of blood and anything else, and Northstar taking a similar shot with the, just a note, she hit him with the flat, I don't know. Here's what I'll say. It's comics. It's one of those things where you can certainly say you've chopped up into a billion pieces, but as a writer in the future, you can go, well, you never saw a body. I'm not sure. You know what I mean?
I am curious how they pull him, you know, back together and such.
Yeah.
I don't remember when he shows up, but I'm pretty sure he does show up later somehow.
And even all the slicing and dicing, there's no separation, if that makes any sense.
I took it as kind of like the Kung Fu movies or whatever, where they've got the sword going through. You don't see anything, and then a few seconds later, you know, the bamboo thing slides in half or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And you absolutely could take it that way.
Yeah. That's how I did take it, so yeah.
Like I said, none of it's shown, so again, it's comics. I'll give them that one.
Yeah, room for interpretation, that's fair. You know, it's something that's not going to traumatize a young kid.
Absolutely, yeah. It's not bloody, it's not particularly gory, none of those things.
Yeah. Again, that's something that I imagine would play out very differently visually today. So, but this was kind of fun. I do think at the end we got kind of a quick wrap up of here's the parts of the story that, you know, we need to spell out in case you missed it because we didn't really give it to you before, which was okay, but yeah, whatever. And then the interplay between Northstar and Aurora there at the end was kind of, you know.
And again, the ambiguous, well, they're not going anywhere. As the police, they'll be there for the police to collect.
Mm-hmm.
Again, doesn't necessarily apply corpses.
Yeah.
It could, but it doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, yeah. And then the backup feature, we get the rest of Snowbird's kind of origin, her meeting Heather and James, Guardian, and this kind of, you know, gets Shaman and Snowbird into Alpha Flight.
Yeah, it's interesting that, as I read these, I felt in many ways, particularly the first one was more of a Shaman story.
Mm-hmm.
This one's kind of more both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly you felt the opposite both times. You said, oh, it's the Snowbird feature. So it's just interesting how, you know, different eyes, tend to see or latch on to different things.
Well, certainly Shaman showed up a lot in the previous one because Snowbird was in the process of being born.
Yes.
But to me, while he's in there, the focus and the purpose of the story was her origin, because we'd already gotten his.
Fair enough.
So, and I think both of them are great characters. Shaman is just a great, unique kind of mystic character.
Yep.
Different than, you know, Doctor Strange or Doctor Druid or something like that. I always thought he was a fun character. So, now with issue number 9, we start into a Sasquatch story, and I guess I've got a lot of nitpicks this evening. Page 2, the first full dialogue balloon. It just struck me as odd when the word adapter was hyphenated, but the more I looked at it, it's like this was hand-lettered. And if the hand-letterer had had the line above it of power and, I don't know, a little bit more to the left or whatever, he could have fit, you know, rigged, he could have then had your adapter all on the same line. This is the kind of thing you wouldn't have today because, well, you know, modern computerized lettering, very easy to go change, but not so much when it was hand-lettered. Again, not a big deal, but just something I kind of noticed of a subtle artifact of the production process.
My guess is, because if you just look in general, that particular word balloon has more dead space than almost any other word balloon, and it's the lines are not space. I have a feeling that was replaced.
It's not just that one. There's a couple others where there's some odd white space in the balloons.
Yeah, there's some, but yeah.
The middle panel there, the bottom one, has a lot of white space off on the right of it.
Mm, yeah, I see what you're saying there.
So, this lettering is an invisible art. It's
absolutely.
You don't notice it when it's done decently or really well, but when it's kind of not so good, you do notice it.
Let's see, Michael Higgins was the letterer here, so.
Not a name I recognized.
I gotta agree, I don't recognize.
This is where, again, Comic Book DB would have been a nice thing to have, because we could have hopped to that issue. He would have been listed as the letterer. You could have clicked on him, done a chronological listing, and seen how much has he done prior to this.
Huh, he actually did some covers as well. Interesting. Okay, yeah. Like I said, I'm not familiar with him, but yeah, he did plenty of lettering work and a few covers.
Yeah. Yeah, this has Walter Lankowski up in the far reaches at a research station because they've got some odd stuff that they're looking into, and it turns out to be, you know, what they think is a signal from space or whatnot. And this is as much a riff on, you know, some of those, I don't want to say horror movies, but you know what I mean. The monster that's out at the far-off research station that wipes everybody else out.
It has a bit of that. Okay, we're going to get there anyways. I love the Super Skrull. I think this was a neat way to bring him in. I thought it was great. Everything about it made sense. I really enjoyed that whole thing.
Well, it was one of those things. When I saw the thing beaming in or whatever, that they played fair. That middle panel on the bottom, it's like, I bet that's the Super Skrull.
Yep.
And how long it takes Sasquatch to kind of figure that out? Not too long. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I did find it interesting is there was something in here, I forget where it was, about how, I guess it was, page 7, where Sasquatch had consulted with the Fantastic Four and see current and upcoming issues of the FF. I'm like, okay, that's an almost helpful, footnote. Denny O'Neill should know better.
It was helpful then. It's not helpful now.
Yes. I'm sure back at the time, because this would have been around Fantastic Four, I think, 266. And I only know that because we're only about 6 months after the last time we had a kind of a quasi-crossover with Fantastic Four, when Namor and Invisible Woman showed up.
Okay.
But yeah, that's kind of, just give me some issue numbers. Come on. But again, when you were commenting about, you know, I bet this wasn't written for the trade, trades didn't exist for the most part back then. This was absolutely written for the audience reading it off the rack as it was released.
Yeah, and to be fair, this issue's cover dated April 1984, which corresponds to Fantastic Four 265, also written by Byrne.
Mm-hmm.
So, interestingly enough, not edited by Denny O'Neill, like this book.
That I'm not too surprised by. And I'm not sure how much longer Denny O'Neill was at Marvel before he went over to DC.
Yeah, that's true, too. It is about that time.
because he was, you know, in charge of the Batman office over at DC for forever and a day, it seemed like. I thought this was some fun stuff. Again, really fleshing out who Walter Lankowski is, who Sasquatch is, and stuff like that. Again, Super Skrull, can't go wrong with him. I'd kind of like to see an adventure of the various Super Skrulls based on other Earth teams, because they'd set that up, and I forget which Marvel event or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But just like they've got this, the classic one based on the Fantastic Four, there's some based on like the original X-Men or this lineup of Avengers or whatnot. I think it'd just be fun to see them kind of out and about adventuring.
And a completely random thing that I've looked up, since I looked up that Fantastic Four issue from the same month or two, The letter we were just discussing, Michael Higgins was the assistant editor over on Fantastic Four, as well as the letterer of this book.
I wonder if he had to do it because whoever was lined up to do it bailed or something.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, more power to him. I mean, he didn't do a bad job. It's just not as polished as, you know, somebody who does it full time would do.
Yep.
Yeah. Again, I thought this was a fun issue. Ended on a nice cliffhanger of Walter about to get, you know, pounded on by the Super Skrull. Yeah.
Yep.
So, fun stuff.
And now an entirely different backup.
Again, going through the various characters, and they're balancing who we're seeing in the lead story with seeing other people in the backup. This time we get Aurora's origin.
Yeah, we get more Aurora. Yeah. It feels very much like the last few issues. And then, of course, the promise of Logan at the very end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Also, I don't know why, but the habit that this particular ladies at the school wear looks like no habit I ever remember actually physically seeing, except Sally Field wearing in The Flying Nun.
I was going to say The Flying Nun, yeah.
I don't think that habit actually exists in the real world, just in comic books and TV, apparently.
Yeah. Definitely a distinctive style.
Yes.
So yeah, they do some good stuff there. It's funny, because as I was reading it, I was spending enough time in the backup feature that by the time I got to the next issue and stuff, which starts with a little bit of a subplot with Guardian, I'd kind of, oh yeah, this is where we left off with Walter. And we left off on a really good cliffhanger.
We did. I was going to say, I got to go back for 1 second, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure.
On page 18.
Okay.
One has to assume that is the nun in the bottom panel.
Oh, absolutely.
Yet, at no other point do we see her holding a cane that I can think of. And seeing as how we just came off a story with Nemesis, and the color choices, and some of the other things, there is room for that to be confusing.
Okay, I didn't have any association with the two, but...
I just looked for a cane on anyone, and I couldn't find one anywhere in the story.
Page 16, bottom corner.
Oh, there, you're right, she does have the cane, fair enough.
But that's the only other time we see it, and it's easy to miss.
Yeah, and, well, because the scene, the panel immediately following this... She's only got the giant key ring.
Well, and the panel above where we've got the cane on 18, it should have been visible there.
Exactly. But she's got her hand kind of in her habit.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyways, okay, we can move on to the next issue.
Yeah, the next issue starts with Guardian getting an apartment in New York. And I'm like, man, I had forgotten he had ever lived in New York for any length of time. And... you know, he's working for Roxxon Oil at this point, and I'm like, yeah, that's not going to end well. Roxxon, evil. And I loved the cameo with Steve Rogers.
Yep.
Of all the buildings, he has to wind up getting a place in the same one as Captain America. That's just funny.
Of course, why not?
So, this is one where I think this issue in particular has a couple of what-if potentials, and one of them would be, you know, what if those two, you know, were, you know, living in the same building for a prolonged period of time and teaming up on a regular basis. Be kind of funny. Because then you know they would have had to have gotten, you know, Mexico equivalent of Captain America and Guardian.
Yeah, and it's weird. I had almost kind of forgotten about the Guardian. It's weird. The first six issues we read, particularly the first four, it felt like he was kind of the leader and the main character of the book. And he had yet to appear in the ones we're reading for this particular issue.
Absolutely the leader, and that's one of those things where, again, it's a non-team book.
Yeah.
You know, because if we go back to, I think, issue 6 was a Snowbird issue, 5 was on Puck, I'm not sure how much he showed up in those two issues. So by that point, we hadn't seen him for a good couple of months. So somebody picking this issue up off the rack, they're like, who is this guy and how's he con-? If they'd only picked up the like 7, 8, and 9 or whatever, been wondering what's going on. How's he connected? So I enjoyed the opening couple of pages, but then we get to page 4 where it's like, oh yeah, back to the story already in progress. It's like, oh yeah, that's where we left off.
Yes.
You know, I thought that was funny. And it was funny because with Super Skrull, I mean, we all remember he's got the Fantastic Four's powers and such, but there were a couple of times in here where he's talking about using his antimatter blast. I'm like, I don't recall him having that, or these hypnotic powers, but he got so many powers, it's easy to lose track of a couple of the lesser used ones.
He's a Skrull. They can kind of do whatever is needed.
Certainly the shape-shifting gives them a lot of flexibility and stuff, but I don't know that most of them have either the hypnotic, maybe the hypnotic. I don't think most of them have the antimatter blast stuff. Some of the stuff we get with Sasquatch here kind of, for lack of a better term, hulking out, I thought was kind of interesting and sets the scenes for some stuff that happens later in the series. Again, some great fun action between the two, some interesting stuff with what's going on with the Super Skrull, and just, it was a ton of fun.
With no editor's note. So the question is, did any of this happen anywhere else? Or is all of this flashback with the cosmic power and everything just
it had
for
to
this?
Happen somewhere.
Yeah.
I was expecting, because it was Spider-Man and Ms. Marvel.
Yep.
That it had, I was thinking it had to be in like Marvel team up.
Yeah.
But I did a little research, not much. I couldn't find where this happened.
Yeah.
But I'll admit I was mainly looking for where does Ms. Marvel show up in that title. It could have just as easily been Spider-Man teaming up in her book.
Yep.
I didn't bother to check.
I just found it interesting that there was no editor's note.
Yeah, a footnote would have been nice.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd put that in my notes if that would have been handy. I do think it was a little harsh of Sasquatch to kind of beam the Super Skrull into, I don't know, some random part of space or whatever. But, you know, hey, you got to get rid of the guy. I get it. And, of course, he comes back. He's still around today.
Of course.
But, yeah. Now, one thing on page 17 that struck me, we get the, hi, honey, I'm home. Okay. Then we get a caption on the next panel. Since the departure of his wife and son nearly 5 years ago, Walt has taken kind of sardonic delight in calling out that prosaic sitcom greeting each evening as he returns to his apartment. Flat out saying, wife and son, gone 5 years ago. And I'm like, as I'm reading this, having read, you know, all the Alpha Flight stuff in Alpha Flight per se afterwards, like, I don't even remember these two. And I'm wondering, were they ever seen? So I dug up the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, and volumes 1 and 2 for Sasquatch, no mention of any known relatives.
Huh.
By the Master Edition, his ex-wife Veronica is mentioned, so presumably she showed up at some point. And if I had to guess, I think it was when Sasquatch was in his white phase and such, just because I think it kind of would have been almost ironic at that point.
Yeah.
But I don't know for sure. And no mention of the son at that point either.
Hmm.
So, and this ending bit kind of tacks on to some of the comments that North Star was making at the end of issue 8.
Yes, and then kind of right back to a North Star story in the backup.
Yeah, his part of the origin and such. And it's funny because when we get the, I guess it was on whichever page it was, where Guardian is basically saying, oh yeah, you got, you know, the nice family, he got put up in a boarding, or you got put up in a boarding school, he got adopted, the other people, they lost track, here's what happened, here's why you guys got split or whatever. There is a what-if story waiting to happen where Aurora is the one who got adopted and had the nice happy life, and North Star goes to the boarding school and gets messed up.
Yeah.
You know? So definitely I think there's some fun stuff if they wanted to go revisit that they could do. The part I thought was, you know, I would have liked to have seen just another panel or two. Because right at the end of this, they're about to, you know, North Star and Aurora shake hands, and as we know, and none of them did at the time, blinding light when they touch.
Mm.
I'm surprised James Hudson didn't get blinded by that. So, and again, this is where the caption in the final panel of, hey, we're going to go on to Sasquatch next issue for the backup. Yeah, we'll spare your eyes the blinding flash.
Yes.
So, again, I think these backup features in the span of just a couple of pages covered a lot of ground, really established the the meat and potatoes of the factual part of the backstory for these characters, while the lead stories were really fleshing out the characterization and some of that stuff for these characters. You know, you look at how unformed these characters were at the beginning of issue one, here we are, you know, less than a year later, and they actually have some solid characterization and backstory now to them.
Oh, yeah.
So I think Byrne was doing a great job on this title. Now, issues 11 and 12 is where I think we actually start to get more of the full team kind of a thing, as you would expect from a team book.
Well, we get a team.
Yeah, I was going to say, more in the 12 than in 11, because I think 11 is more the former Beta and Gamma Flight members becoming Omega Flight.
Yes. Yeah.
And all of those characters we actually saw in issue 1 when we got the lineup of Beta and Gamma Flights. They didn't have names. We just saw who they were. Now we actually get to know who they are. And we get to see Box, Diamond Lil, Flashback, Smart Aleck, and Wild Child. And some of these are some fun characters. This was, I think, these two issues were part of the storyline that really, I think, tied the book together quite a bit when it was first coming out.
Yes. It's interesting. What was it, 4 issues ago, where we had the one page that kind of set this up?
Mm-hmm. 2 pages, I think it was. At
yeah,
the end
fair
of
enough.
7 or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
And again, they were playing fair. We knew stuff was going on in the background. We didn't need to see all of it.
Yep.
And starting with Box kind of getting recruited there, you know, we can fill in the gaps as we're getting told the stuff. Setting this in New York did feel a little odd, but I think they did have a rationale for doing it, both because that's where Roxxon kind of was headquarters, and strategically there was some advantages to it for taking down Alpha Flight.
Well, and half of it, well, she's shown here. I'm assuming Heather becomes so important to this story, so it makes sense there as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, all of this is a revenge story against Guardian.
Yes.
So getting him isolated from the rest of Alpha Flight makes sense. Using Heather as kind of the bait, the hostage or whatever, makes sense. Getting a lot of the Beta and Gamma Flight members as the team to go for him to go up against. That was interesting, because it kind of implied Department H didn't really do good psyche vows.
Mm.
Because it seemed like this group was pretty willing to turn on James. And he was the head of that, you know, project and stuff, so a little surprising. There was a fair amount of exposition here of, you know, who is Jerome Jackson, why do we care, and all of that. I don't recall if he was named in the backup feature when we got Guardian's Origin or not.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'd have to go check. I didn't think to do that. But I thought this had some fun stuff with Guardian kind of coming back to the forefront. And, you know, it's funny because it's, what, page 12 when we get kind of the cliffhanger ending and then go into a fairly lengthy backup feature on Sasquatch.
Yes.
So definitely giving it, again, that kind of anthology feel to this title, you know? Because these days, the backup features would always be a set number of pages every issue and fairly predictable. Here, sometimes they were, you know, 3 pages or in this case, significantly longer. But with Sasquatch, there's a fair amount of ground to cover because, you know, in the one issue, we've got to, you know, get him powered, get his backstory with Banner, you know, all of that kind of stuff and get it going. I think they could have trimmed it down a bit if they had needed to do it in fewer pages, but it was nice to have the room.
Yeah, the 3 pages of Snowbird looking for him certainly could have been cut down.
Yeah, but she hadn't really been seen at all since issue 6.
Yeah.
So figuring we needed to get some of these characters kind of back on screen before we use them next issue.
Well, except she was in the last few backups. Right?
Yeah, I guess so, you're right.
Her and Shaman were kind of the backups at the beginning of this.
She was there, but it didn't feel like Snowbird was there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I clearly agree, because I thought it was more Shaman, yes.
Yeah, I definitely think that part of the backup could have been trimmed down. The page or two of him transforming and running amok, all that, I mean, they could have been tighter if they'd needed to.
Yeah.
So, again, some fun stuff. And then we get to Issue 12, double-sized issue.
Yes, it was.
And a pivotal issue, I think, for the book.
Okay, makes sense.
You know, we get some recap of, you know, the whole trap that's been set for Guardian. Again, more backstory on Jerome and stuff. And really, I think the first, I don't know, quarter of the book, it seems like, is geared towards, if you haven't read the book before, here's everything you need to know, which I appreciate.
Okay.
I did find it funny when Shaman and Snowbird were like, okay, we're waiting for everyone to come here so we can go help out, because they've gotten the call, which is, I think, the first call that's gone out since the first issue.
Yes.
We then have to gather Alpha Flight from literally across Canada. We got people over in Vancouver. We got some of them over in Toronto and whatnot. And this is where, man, really handy to have two speedsters that can fly. Because, you know, no teleporters or anything like that. How else are you going to gather the team? So, and we get an explanation as to why Marina, who hadn't been in the book since, what, the fourth issue, is not going to be in the story for the rest of this issue. We at least address her lack of participation. But this is another one where it does seem to take a little bit to gather the team. And of course, what's the first thing they do when they get together? They start fighting. And I'm like, okay. The one time we get a footnote in here that really surprised me was on page 16.
Oh, okay.
Sasquatch is basically, you know, backhanding North Star. And it's like, although North Star and Aurora possess super speed, their reflexes are not proportionately faster. And I'm like, wait a sec. Moving at super speed without faster reflexes seems like a really deadly combination. But, okay. You kind of got to do that, because otherwise you can't surprise a speedster, and these sorts of, you know, fights go very differently very quickly. And there was an aspect of this fight where Sasquatch is kind of going nuts again. I don't know, it almost reminded me of the initial Fantastic Four story where they were all fighting.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. That being said, the way they solve that, I think, is really, again, I just like Shaman. I thought that was a really neat way to deal with this.
Yeah, yeah. Shaman was always fun in this book. He could pull whatever he needed to out of his magic bag and stuff, yet there was always, it felt like rules to it, so he couldn't just do anything, but it was cool. And then when he kind of, you know, transports them smack dab into, you know, Guardian's fight with Omega Flight, that was kind of fun. And Omega Flight is just a bit of a fun team, and they're not just cookie cutter characters, if you know what I mean. I mean,
no, they're not. They're unique. They're interesting.
Yeah, I mean, Smart Aleck is a different take on the genius character. Flashback has some passing similarities to Multiple Man or whatever, but is very distinct in how his powers work differently and such. You could argue Wild Child is a, you know, a poor man, Sabretooth, or Wolverine, but again, very different kind of a character,
yep.
Even though they're of the same type. So yeah, I thought they were fun characters, and then getting to see, you know, everyone kind of fighting and using their powers and stuff was fun, so.
The fights were fun. All of that said, I cannot for the life of me figure out exactly what happened at the end of this.
Okay.
And since we stopped reading it there, there's a part of me that wants to go on, and there's a part of me that's like, I have no idea what happened.
Yeah, definitely a pivotal moment for the book.
Okay.
And if you're game for doing the next 12 issues.
Okay.
I think there's some ramifications of what happens here with the other characters and such that plays out, if I recall correctly, I think through issue 25.
I don't know. From the android that takes Heather to was this Guardian to is Box a good guy? There's so much of this I don't understand.
Okay, well, if you go to page 35,
okay,
we get some clarity on that.
Okay.
And basically, the fight with Box pretty much toasts Guardian's suit. It's getting pretty well shredded.
Yes, absolutely. And same thing with Box's robot.
Yeah, yeah. So, definitely, there was an aspect of page 36 where I'm thinking, you know, maybe the design of Guardian's suit could have been improved a little bit. It seemed a little, didn't take the damage well. And if you're going to be a superhero, you've got to be able to take some damage better than this. And certainly the timing of Heather kind of walking in to what she does, a little unfortunate.
Well, okay, but that at least makes sense. Back to page 35. Who was that in the first panel?
That was Jerome.
That's Jerome?
Panel 2, Mr. Jackson. But Jerry Jackson says nothing. He was piloting Box.
Okay, not okay, because Roger's in panel three, right? Okay.
Yeah, he's tied up off on the side.
Okay, so Jerome was the one running. Okay, so Roger was never really kind of one of them.
Bottom of page 33.
Okay.
But I'm not Roger Box, I'm Jackson.
I'm Jackson. No, I picked that up. But, okay. Everyone seems unreliable. I have no idea who to believe here, but fair enough.
Yeah, up until this point, I'm like, why was Box turning on
Guardian.
Hudson? Yeah. And at this point, it's like, oh, okay.
Okay.
But, I mean, this issue has a ton of characters. There's a lot to keep track of.
There really is. And as someone who's not that familiar with any of these characters, I got to the end, I'm like, I have no idea what happened. Should I read the next one? Should I not? I don't know. So
it comes down to if you're enjoying it or not. I think Byrne had a fairly good run on this. There's some stuff that definitely had ramifications later that was kind of fun. I was on for the whole run of the title. There was a point at which it definitely had some ups and downs over the years. And I think after this, it's been forever since I've read the rest of John Byrne's part of this run. I think it was not as much of a non-team book after this, because they'd had the time to kind of establish the characters.
Got it.
But I could be wrong on that. I just don't remember.
And based on what I've seen here, I'm assuming Heather has to become Guardian?
Vindicator, actually, but yes.
Okay, same difference.
Yeah.
New name.
Old name.
Oh, okay, fair enough, yes.
Because that's what he started as and changed to Guardian changed in the Guardian. Span of the first few issues, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But Byrne was on this until, I want to say, issue 27, 28, I think.
Okay.
And then it crossed over with the Hulk that was being done, I think, by Bill Mantlow at the time. And they go into the crossover with each other, swap books, and come out the other way.
Mm.
Which was kind of interesting.
Which means at some point, Bill Mantlow takes this title over.
With issue 29.
Okay. I will definitely keep reading.
Which is interesting because that's part 5 of 5. It's an epilogue of a...
of the crossover you just mentioned.
Well, the crossover was mainly 28 and 29. But 28 was, you know... Oh, hang on. Maybe that was the back...
Well, that makes
this
sense.
Is all part... around the time of Secret Wars 2, so yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
I could have told you this a lot better back, you know, in 85, I think.
Well, heck, I just read this last night and I, like I said, not 100% sure what happened, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, and with books like this, you've got to pay, I think, a bit more attention than you do today because, you know, you kind of gloss over a panel and you can miss some key plot points.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, this issue really effectively introduced, you know, 6 or 7 characters. We've got, you know, the rest of Alpha Flight back in the mix, finally. There's a lot going on, a lot of fighting and stuff. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, Alpha Flight versus Omega Fight... again, today would have been a 6-issue arc.
Yeah.
You know? So, I enjoyed the stuff. I thought it was fun. I liked having a book that was in the Marvel Universe, but off to the side. So, it wasn't, you know, neck deep in continuity with everything else. Because I'm trying to... when was Secret Wars again?
I have no idea.
Because Secret Wars 2 was around 28 or whatever of this, so... this one didn't touch Secret Wars, so I don't have a clear on and off on that.
Well, Secret Wars 2...
that's the one that's around issue 28 and 29, thereabouts.
Is September 85 to March 86.
When was the first Secret Wars? Because that was when I started going from having Alpha Flight and Fantastic Four, i.e. Byrne books, to most of the rest of the Marvel Universe.
Got it.
So...
looks like May 84 to April of 85, so they were pretty... close on the heels of each other.
Wow, okay, yeah. Because at this point, we end around July 84.
Okay, yeah.
So I thought it was fun. Again, some of these characters are, you know, different riffs on, you know, standard ideas or whatever. And, you know, Canadian slant on the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was just kind of fun.
Yeah, and as a total aside, and another reason I will definitely keep going, it looks like when Bill Mantlow comes over, so does Mike Mignola.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, if you want to do more of these down the line, I'm definitely game for that.
Absolutely.
So, love John Byrne's stuff. I think he did, I would say, absolutely the definitive run on Alpha Flight.
Well, they're his characters, so yeah.
Well, and, you know, he's Canadian, so he added that flavor to it. And he planted the seeds that let this book run for about 130 issues, plus a couple of volumes afterwards, plus a couple of, you know, other titles that these characters showed up in later.
Yep.
So, ton of fun stuff.
Absolutely. This was a lot of fun. Just very different than anything I'm used to. But it's nice to enjoy something that is at least new to me,
mm-hmm.
that I'm really enjoying. So, yes.
Well, there's a lot to be said for, you know, figuring out what kind of stories you want and then looking for back issue stories or issues that have those.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, a lot of this run of the book is, you know, $2.99 or whatever at mycomicshop.com, you know, for a, you know, very fine or whatever kind of copy of it. So it's, these issues are, you know, sometimes cheaper than modern comics.
Yep.
And they're time tested.
Yeah, and again, I've read all this, including all the other Marvel books we've done for whatever it is, like $60 a year I pay for the Marvel Unlimited app.
Absolutely. You can't go wrong with that, I think.
Yeah, not even close.
You know, for the cost of, you know, an issue or two of a modern book, you've got the, I don't say the entire library of Marvel, but everything they've got up digitally.
Exactly. A very large portion of it.
Yeah. So at that point, all you need is the time to read it.
Yep.
So, cool. Anything else?
No, I'm good.
Awesome.
The December previews came out on November 24th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 169 is the morning of Saturday, December 4th. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.